Chapter 31. Biography. Although Outlander authors kill, maim, disfigure, and eviscerate book people on a regular basis, no author has ever been held to account, although lawyers are working on a test case to deal with serial offenders. The mechanism for transfictional jurisdiction has yet to be finalized, but when it is, some authors may have cause to regret their worst excesses. Bradshaw's Bookworld Companion, 16th edition. The Hotel Verhagen landed on the lawn outside one of the biographical tenements. I sat for several moments in silence in the lobby. For some odd reason, my left leg wouldn't stop shaking, and when I tried to speak, it sounded like I was hyphenated. I'd been fine on the trip down, but as soon as I started to think about the men in plaid who tried so hard to kill us, I suddenly felt all hot and fearful. I thought for a moment it might have been a virus I'd picked up from the real world, until I realized I was in mild shock. I rested for 10 minutes, and after downing one of Sprocket's restoratives and writing "very nice" in the guest book, I stepped from Verhagen, which lifted off behind us. The manager wasn't going to hang around. The pay and display fees in biography were ridiculous. Sprocket, I said, as we walked across the car park, where did you learn to drive like that?
My cousin Malcolm, ma'am.
He's a racing driver?
He's a racing car.
Is Madam all right? Madam is surprised she didn't scream, vomit, and then pass out. I owe you my life, Sprocket.
A good butler, intoned Sprocket airily, should save his employer's life at least once a day, if not more than once.
Luckily for us, the Island of Biography had elected to maintain parts of the Great Library model during the remaking. So while the geographic model gave it the appearance of a low-lying island mostly covered with well-kept gardens, exciting statuary, and dignified pavilions of learning, the biographical subjects themselves lived in 26 large tower blocks, each designated by a single letter painted conveniently on the front. The lobby of the apartment building was roomy and bright, and was connected to a game room where D.H. Lawrence was playing H.P. Lovecraft at ping-pong, and also a cafeteria where we could see Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther discussing the struggles of faith over conscience. In the lobby were 8 different Lindsay Lohans, all arguing over which biographical study had been the least correct. Even before I reached the front desk, I knew we were in luck. The receptionist recognized me.
"Hello again, Miss Next," he said cheerfully. "How did the peace talks go?"
"They're not until Friday."
"How silly of me. You can go straight up. I'll ring ahead to announce you."
"Most kind," I replied, still unsure whom Thursday had seen. "Remind me again the floor?"
"4th, said the receptionist,
and he turned to the telephone switchboard. We took the brass and cast-iron elevator, which was of the same design as the one in the Great Library. The two buildings shared similar bookworld architecture. Even the paint was peeling in the same places.
"How long do you think before the men in plaid catch up with us?" asked Sprocket, as the elevator moved upwards.
"I have no idea," I replied, opening my pistol and chambering my last cartridge, a disruptor that was nicknamed the Cherry Fondue, as it was always the last one in the box, and extremely nasty. "But the Hotel Verhagen won't give them any clues. You signed the register as Mr. and Mrs. Duffer, yes?"
Yes, said Sprocket, his eyebrow pointer clicking to apologetic.
"Problems?"
"Indeed, ma'am. In an unthinking moment, I may have written 'Choice of Oils Open to Improvement' in the comments section of the visitor's book."
"We'll just have to hope they're not curious." I replaced the weapon in my shoulder holster, and the lift doors opened on the 4th floor. We walked out and padded noiselessly down the corridor.
We walked past Lysander, Lyons, Lindsay, Lynch, and Lynham, before we got to the Lyles. Charles Lyle, botanist, read the name on the first door. "Is botany boring?" I asked. "I suspect that it isn't, ma'am, given there is an entire island committed to little else." The next door was for Sir James Lyle, politician. "Boring, ma'am?" inquired Sprocket. "Politicians' lives are never boring," I assured him, and we moved to the next. "Sir Charles Lyle, geologist," I read. "Is geology more or less boring than politics or botany?" Sprocket's pointer flicked to bingo. "I believe, ma'am, that as regards boring, geology is less to do with tediousness and more to do with drilling." "Genius," I remarked, mildly annoyed that I hadn't thought of it myself. Sir Charles Lyle was the father of modern geology. If Thursday had come to him, she was after the finest geological advice available in the book world. I knocked on the door, in a state of some excitement. And when I heard a shrill, "Enter!" we walked in. The room was a spacious panelled study, the walls covered with bookcases, and a large walnut desk in the centre. It was not tidy. Papers were strewn everywhere, and a chair was overturned. The pictures were crooked, and a plant pot lay on its side. The wall safe, usually hidden behind a painting of a rock, was open and empty. A man of considerable presence was standing in the middle of the chaos. He had a high-domed head, white sideburns, and somewhat small eyes that seemed to glisten slightly with inner thoughts of a distracting nature. "Thursday," he said when he saw me. "I have to confess I'm not pleased." "Oh, yes. You told me that my assignment with you would be of the utmost secrecy. Look at my study, ransacked." "Ah," I said, glancing around. "I am most dreadfully sorry, Sir Charles. This was done after we came back from..."
"An after-lifetime's work ruined," he said in a much aggrieved tone. "I am most displeased, good Lord. Who is that mechanical man with the curiously emotive eyebrow?"
"My butler, Sir Charles. You have no objection?" He stared at Sprocket curiously.
"When I was alive, I pursued the advancement of scientific truth with all passion. I am afraid to say that I am at odds to explain fiction, which often seems to have no basis in logic at all."
"Some enjoy it precisely for that reason."
"You may be right. Can he tidy?"
"We can both tidy, Sir Charles." And we started to pick up the papers.
"It is most unfortunate," remarked Sir Charles, "after we had done all that work together, most unfortunate."
I suddenly felt worried.
"Our work together? The report," he muttered. "All the maps, notes, core samples, graphs, analysis, stolen."
"Sir Charles," I said, "this might seem an odd request, but can you go over what was in the report?"
"Again?"
"Again." He blinked owlishly at me.
"Over tea, Miss Next. First we must tidy."
"Sir Charles," I said, in a more emphatic tone, "you must tell me what was in the report, and now." He frowned at me.
"As you wish. All that metaphor..."
He didn't have time to finish his sentence. With a tremendous crash, the door was pushed off its hinges, and two men in plaid entered. From door to death was scarcely less than 15 seconds, and much happened. Sprocket was between us and the MIP, and he valiantly made a lunge for the intruders. The first plaid was quicker, and before we knew it, had popped Sprocket's inspection panel and pressed his emergency spring release. In an instant, the butler fell lifeless. Before Sprocket hit the floor, the plaid had advanced, knocked my pistol from my grasp, and pushed me sideways. As I lay sprawling, the second man in plaid picked up Sir Charles and threw him bodily out the window. while the first plaid moved towards me, his expressionless eyes boring into mine like a pair of gimlets. We'd just killed 6 of their compatriots. I don't think there was much room for negotiation. I quickly scrambled across the floor and was grabbed by my foot. I wriggled out of my boot. And it was this, I think, that saved us. The man in plaid was put off balance and gave me the split second I needed to find my pistol. Without hesitation, I turned and fired. There was a whoompa noise, and the air wobbled as the cherry fondue hit home. With an agonizing scream of pain, the man in plaid exploded into not graphemes, but the infinitely more painful words, many of which embedded themselves into the woodwork like shards of glass. The blast caught the second man in plaid and cut him in two. He fell to the floor with a heavy thump, the lower half of him spilling cogs, springs, and brass actuating rods onto the floor. "You're robotic," I said, moving closer. The man in plaid was moving his arms in a feeble manner, and his eyes followed me as I approached. He was still functioning, but it was clear he was damaged well beyond economic repair. He looked as though he was out of warranty, too.
"You are impressive, Miss Next," he managed to say. "A worthy adversary."
"Who sent you?"
"I don't answer questions. I ask them."
I noticed I was shaking. I retrieved my boot and walked to the broken window. Lying on the grass, 4 stories below, was Sir Charles. The heavy impact had caused the binding matrix of his body to become fused to the ground, and he was beginning to merge with the lawn. I could see several people staring up and pointing, first at me, and then at the remains of Sir Charles. We didn't have long before someone called jurisfiction. Lyle could be rewritten, but these things take time and money, and biography's budget was tighter than ours. Sprocket was lying flat on his face in an undignified manner, and I quickly rewound him. As soon as his gyros, thought cogs, and speech diaphragm were back up to speed, he sat up.
"I've had the most peculiar dream," he told me, his eyebrow clicking through each emotion in turn, and then back again. "About being caught by my mother oiling a Mark III Ford Capri in an inappropriate manner."
"I didn't know you had a mother."
"I don't. That's what was so peculiar."
"See what you can get out of him," I said, pointing to the damaged man in plaid. "I'm going to have a look around." I didn't waste any time, and hunted through the remains of Lyle's study to see what, if anything, had been left behind. The short answer was not much, until I went through the waste paper basket and came across a pencil sketch of Racy Novel with woman's fiction on one side and dogma on the other. A rough outline of the geology had been sketched in, and for the most part the strata were more or less identical beneath all the genres, except for a shaded patch the shape of a tailless salmon that seemed to be mostly beneath Racy Novel. I returned to where Sprocket had been talking with the badly damaged plaid.
"He's a duplex 6, said Sprocket, with a sense of deep respect. "I was wondering why they managed to stay on our tail so easily during the oversized books section."
"Who is he working for?"
"He won't tell us, but it's of no matter. The duplex automaton's memories are recorded on punched tape. We can have it read."
"So remove his tape and let's get out of here." In reply, the duplex 6 took a large brass key from his jacket pocket and inserted it into the socket in the base of his neck. We could see he was almost run down, and before we could stop him, he had started to turn the key.
"Good Lord," said Sprocket, "the duplex 6 has a self-wind capability."
Sprocket tried to stop the damaged man in plaid from winding himself up, but the 6's superior strength was too much, and we watched with increased hopelessness as the plaid's tension indicator neared the red line.
"We are leaving," said Sprocket.
And without waiting for a reply, he took me by the hand, and we ran to the bathroom window and out the fire escape at the back of the building.
We were two flights down when the Duplex 6's mainspring finally ruptured in an almighty outburst of stored mechanical energy. There was a loud twang noise, and the shattered remains of the man in plaid erupted out the windows of Lyle's apartment. We were showered with minute cogs, sprockets, bevel gears and dogs, chains, pushrods and actuators.
"A self-winding capability," said Sprocket, who was obviously deeply impressed. "I wonder if they could retrofit that feature for us Duplex Fives."